I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. My guest today is Andre Davis, a former judge who since 2017 has served as the city solicitor of Baltimore. He manages the city law department, and he is one of five officials who serve on the Board of Estimates. And when Catherine Pugh resigned from office 3 weeks ago, it was Andre Davis who drafted her resignation letter. Mr. Davis signed the letter as well, approving it as legal under the city charter, allowing the smooth transition of power to Mayor Jack Young. The transition may have been smooth, but little else has been in the weeks since the Pugh resignation. In particular, a ransomware attack has crippled the city's computer system. Andre Davis joins me with his unique perspective on where the city has been and where we're headed when Midday gets underway after these headlines. Good afternoon and welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. My guest today is Andre Davis, the Baltimore City Solicitor. He was appointed to his post by then-Mayor Catherine Pugh in September of 2017 after 30 years as a judge on local, state, and federal courts, including 8 years on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit. As city solicitor, he is one of five members of the city's Board of Estimates. He also directs the city's legal department. It's about 100 lawyers and support personnel. Judge Davis's tenure as solicitor has coincided with a tumultuous time for our city. Think about what's happened in just this month alone. Mayor Pugh's resignation 3 weeks ago followed revelations about unethical and potentially criminal behavior while in office. City government itself has become the victim of cyber criminals who are demanding a ransom after debilitating Baltimore's computer system. The running of the Preakness Stakes on Saturday focused attention on the inattention the Pimlico racetrack has received from its owners, the Stronach Group. The city has sued the Stronach Group to take over ownership of the beleaguered racetrack. Andre Davis is in the middle of the mix of all of it. Throughout the recent chaotic and unsettling developments at City Hall, the former jurist has been widely credited with being a stabilizing force and a steady hand as the city ship continues to navigate through some very choppy waters. Andre Davis joins me in Studio A. Mr. Solicitor, welcome to the show. It's good
Thank you.
See you.
Thank you, Tom. It's really great to be back.
Well, I really appreciate it. Let's begin first by talking about Mayor Catherine Pugh, former Mayor Catherine Pugh. When's the last time you spoke with her?
It's been at least a month now.
Do you have any idea, have you spoken to anybody who has been in touch with her? Do you have any idea of the condition of her health, her physical and her mental health?
I do not.
Can you walk us through the month between the time she went on an extended leave of absence, an indefinite leave of absence, the 1st of April, and the 2nd of May, when she signed that letter that you had drafted for her? I mean, can you give us some perspective about what took place at City Hall and what your understanding of her state of mind was during those weeks?
I'll try, Tom. I'll start by saying what I think most people know, and that is that at the end of March, really middle to the end of March, Catherine was very ill. And like many workaholics, she was not listening to her advisors in terms of the need for rest and recuperation. And I don't think she was listening very much to her doctors. She continued to work. She was really suffering physically. And finally, she went into the hospital. With pneumonia and who knows what else. She was very weak. She was very, very concerned about her own personal circumstances and the circumstances of the city. As people know, she decided in early April, April 1st, in fact, to take a leave of absence at the urging of those in City Hall who care very deeply about her and her condition. And at that point, Mayor Young became ex officio mayor. Sharon Middleton became the president pro tem of the Board of Estimates. And so the focus in City Hall was, let's all pull together and keep the ship of state, as it were, sailing true. But there was a lot of uncertainty, of course. Frankly, from my impressions in talking to her, Catherine got weaker after she took the leave of absence. And so the question became, as we all waited and wondered, would she come back? There were further revelations about her activities with the University of Maryland Medical System and others. As information came out, it came to look like it was unlikely that she would return to City Hall as mayor. And she engaged in a process. I was in touch with her personal attorney. We had very good discussions about what was best for Catherine, what was best for the city, what was going on in the city. He and I jointly were assessing what the public reactions to the revelations were. And I think that Catherine went through a process in which she finally got to the point where she recognized that, quite apart from her physical challenges in terms of the illness, that politically the circumstances were such that it was untenable for her to seek to come back to City Hall. All the while, Mayor Young, again, was absolutely laser-focused on the city's business, as were the members of the council, as were the directors of the departments and the agency heads around the city, and the work continued to get done. And finally, as we know, Catherine decided that what was best for her and what was best for the city and the city government, she signed the letter that, you're right, I had drafted and attested to the legal sufficiency of her formal resignation. And we're looking forward and moving forward from that point.
But that decision was hers. This is not a decision she reached with you or in consultation with Mayor Young or anybody else.
Nobody in City Hall had anything to do with her decision-making. She was in consultation with her family, I'm sure, with her attorney, and with members in the community, her dear friends and supporters with whom she consulted. But no one in City Hall had any input into her decision to resign.
My guest is Andre Davis. He's the Baltimore City Solicitor. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. We'll take your calls and comments a little bit later in the program, but for the moment, if you'd like, you can join us on the Facebook page at WYPR, where we are streaming our conversation. So, Mr. Solicitor, on the 25th of April, as I'm certain you recall, there were raids conducted by the Criminal Division of the IRS, the FBI, on seven different locations. It is almost, as I understand it, never the case that a raid like that is conducted without a good bit of investigation prior to that raid happening. So a judge isn't going to sign a warrant for allowing those raids to take place unless there's sufficient evidence that there is reason to believe crimes have occurred. To your knowledge, have any subpoenas been issued to people in the city government in relation to the UMMS scandal or in relation to the Healthy Holly scandal or any of Catherine Pugh's activities while in office?
As I've disclosed before, Tom, to my knowledge, one subpoena and only one subpoena has been served on city government, specifically calling for a production of documents from the Mayor's Office of Employment, which is a longstanding government office here in Baltimore. The return date on that subpoena is coming up next week. Despite the shutdown in technology, I know that the city has been hard at work. Employees have been hard at work gathering the documents that are called for in that grand jury subpoena. But other than that one, which was specifically related to the MCAT organization out in Park Heights.
It's that the Maryland Center for Adult Training.
Yes.
Right?
Mm-hmm. The focus of the subpoena was on those documents. We are doing the best we can to collect those documents, and we expect next week to produce those documents as called for by the subpoena. No other subpoenas have been served on the city in connection with the federal investigation. We did receive subpoenas from the state prosecutor. I think people are aware of that. I don't recall precisely how many. I think it was two or three. And we have satisfied that production by producing documents to the state prosecutor.
Were you aware that these investigations were underway prior in the weeks, months, even perhaps years prior to the raids that occurred on April 25th?
Certainly before April 25th, I was aware of the state investigation. You'll recall that some days before that, I don't recall the precise date, the governor had called for an investigation by the state prosecutor, and I believe it was just a couple of days after that public announcement that we received the first of a few subpoenas from the state prosecutor. I was not aware until the execution of the search warrants on April 25th of the existence of a federal investigation.
As a former federal judge, you certainly know how this process works better than anybody. Is it likely, is it probable that Catherine Pugh herself was aware or her attorneys were aware that she was under investigation prior to those raids on the 25th?
I'm not able to say. Sometimes a person of interest is aware, either personally or through his or her attorney, that some federal agency, such as the U.S. Attorney's Office, has begun an investigation, but equally likely, really, that the person of interest and or his attorney does not have knowledge of the existence of the investigation. So I'm not able to say whether there was prior knowledge on the part of anybody connected to the investigation.
Because there have been some reports that say that this investigation may have begun as much as 2 years prior to the thing. Now, I'm not sure where that information comes from specifically. I didn't do that reporting personally. But if it is a 2-year investigation, or even a 1-year or a 6-month investigation, did you see any signs working as closely as you did with then Mayor Pugh that this was informing or influencing her behavior and her decision making in office while this was happening?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. I had not heard that there was an allegation that an open investigation, either federal or state, was ongoing. And I can tell you, and the people of Baltimore, I saw absolutely nothing in my time in City Hall about former Mayor Pugh or anybody else in City Hall, with the exception of the known investigations of our fine Inspector General Isabel Cumming, who was involved in a few investigations along the way in the last year and a half. But no, other than that, I was not aware of any ongoing or incipient investigation of anybody.
When it comes to things like MCAT, the Maryland Center for Adult Training, and that's one of the places that was raided, and as you mentioned, a subpoena has been issued for a related city agency. As a solicitor, what's your opinion about the advisability of a person holding elective office like Mayor Pugh to be on the board of such a nonprofit and to even, in her case, chair that board, to be involved so deeply? And she appointed some people on the board who are close staff people of hers at City Hall. I mean, there's a very, very, you know, a strong link between city government and that particular nonprofit, which did receive some money, not a lot, but some money from the city. Is that moving forward, is that a good idea?
Tom, I think public officials elected and appointed have a duty, frankly, beyond their official duties, to support community organizations. And one of the best ways to do that is to serve as trustees and directors. We have hundreds and hundreds of organizations in Baltimore and outside of Baltimore that work with the people of Baltimore. And so I don't want to suggest in any way, shape, or form that elected officials or appointed officials should shy away from supporting such organizations through service. On the other hand, best practices, it seems to me, clearly indicate that one should not serve on the board of an organization where one would be called upon to recuse oneself. Just don't serve. There are
don't even get to the point where you got to recuse.
Exactly. Now, to be sure, there are circumstances where a person must leave the room when a certain discussion takes place because of some other involvement that person may have. And that's very common. But clearly, I think we've seen it is absolutely highly desirable that elected and appointed high officials in city government or state government, for that matter, stay away from organizations that may have some kind of business relationship with that government, clearly.
It's been reported, and you've said before, that you were not aware of a business relationship between Catherine Pugh and Kaiser Permanente, for example. And this was a contract that came up for approval by the Board of Estimates. One of the things that's really puzzling, and I spoke to a gentleman, George Nielsen, who held the position you now hold in previous administrations, and he said, you know, if Catherine Pugh had recused herself from that discussion of the Kaiser Permanente contract, instead of passing 5-0, it would have passed 4-0, and it still would have passed. I mean, what can you speculate? And again, it's speculation, but what was she thinking? Do you have any insight into what was going on there in that process?
I won't speculate. I can't speculate. I have no idea what she was thinking. And George is certainly right. The problem with the circumstances that situation presents has to do with perceptions. You know, I think most of us understand that conflicts of interest are to be avoided. They are corrosive of public trust. And they could cost the government money. But even perceptions of conflicts of interest have those effects. And so it's really important that people pay attention to their commitments overall and take appropriate steps not to create even the perception of a conflict of interest. So I don't know why people who have such conflicts or are perceived to have such conflicts fail to appreciate the perception that's created and the corrosive effect on public trust. But I hope that we do better going forward, frankly.
Andre Davis is the city solicitor of Baltimore. We'll have more with Solicitor Davis when Midday continues after a quick break, and we'll take your calls and comments. 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org, our Twitter handle @MiddayWYPR, and you can catch us on the WYPR Facebook page. By the way, in case you haven't heard, this news out of Baltimore County, the county school board has chosen a new superintendent. He is Daryl L. Williams, a school administrator from Montgomery County. His appointment still has to be approved by the state school superintendent, Karen Salmon. She refused to approve the board's last choice, Dr. Verlita White, who has been serving in an interim capacity since the resignation of Dallas Dance in 2017. She had applied for the job in this and other rounds of application as well. The board was divided 8-4 on the appointment of Dr. Williams. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. Stay with us. Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow, former WYPR producer Lawrence Lanahan joins me to talk about his new book, The Lines Between Us, Two Families and a Quest to Cross Baltimore's Racial Divide. The book has its roots in the award-winning WYPR radio series, which Lawrence produced in 2012 and 13. Mark Carter, the executive director of the New Song Community Learning Center in Sandtown, Winchester, will also join us. Plus, theater critic J. Wynn Russick reviews Queen's Girl in Africa and Queen's Girl in the World, two new plays by Colleen Sinnott Jennings that are in repertory at the Baltimore Everyman Theater. So that's coming up tomorrow on Midday. If you've just joined us today, Baltimore City Solicitor Andre Davis is with me here in Studio A. Our phone number, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle is @MiddayWYPR. If you want to follow me on Twitter, that's always encouraged, @TomHallWYPR, and we are streaming on the WYPR Facebook page. Mr. Solicitor, if we could go to the phones, we're going to meet James in Baltimore City. James, welcome to the program with Andre Davis.
Great. How are we doing today?
I'm a mess, but I'm blessed. I don't know about you, Mr.
Solicitor. That's great. I just have a quick comment, quick question. One, the mediocrity out of City Hall, police department, and school system has been something that's been going on years that's supported by a democratic political system. So why shouldn't we disband political systems in Baltimore, as well as we should demand more excellence from our leaders as a predominantly African-American city, and all the things we talk about that have been done to us by white people? We're not doing the same things to ourselves and our citizens. And lastly, why shouldn't the governor step in and put this city into receivership or a control board in place, because obviously the citizens and the elected officials are unable to run a city with excellence and efficiency and do what they're supposed to do. Thank you.
Thanks for that call, James. You know, James is voicing an opinion. People are just so unsettled and disconcerted, and this whole all of these series of events over the last several weeks, it's just been a kick in the solar plexus of the body politic.
I think that's a very accurate characterization of what we just heard, Tom. I have to push back on some of the premises that James expressed. I don't believe we have mediocre people in Baltimore City. I think we have strong, resilient people, visionary leaders, some of whom, all of us, are flawed in some way or another. Michael Harrison, I'll use a new member of our community. There's nothing mediocre
He's
about
new
Michael
police,
Harrison.
Police commissioner.
Police
right?
commissioner. He is going to take the police department to new heights. That's my prediction, and I hope that the community will gather around and support his efforts. He's a visionary leader. I think Jack Young is not mediocre. Jack has devoted his life, his adult life, to supporting the city in so many different ways. So, yes, we have some problems. Yes, we've suffered some blows, but I don't think we're anywhere near a situation where we want the government to come in, the state government to come in, and deprive the people of Baltimore City of their right to self-governance.
We have an email from Terrence who said, you said at a recent Board of Estimates meeting that there was an appraisal for the 22 acres of the Gwynns Fall Park, which established the value received by Baltimore City residents by BGE and their parent company, Exelon. Where can that appraisal be found?
I did not say that. The dispute over the value of the Leakin Park easement. I'm going to refer to it as an easement. The term that's been bandied about is franchise. And that's a legal term, of course, found in city law. But the fact of the matter is
This is for BGE to oversee a pipeline that goes through the park?
To restore its existing pipeline through the park. Pipeline's been there for many decades. It needed refurbishment. Maintenance, and that's the agreement that the city entered into with BG&E. But somewhere out there, there's this idea that there was a $22 million or $24 million appraisal that, according to the advocates, the Department of Rec and Park came up with, and that's been denied. That's been denied. So we believe that what the city has done in respect to Leakin Park and that pipeline is perfectly consistent with city law. Others disagree with that, and that's what makes it interesting day to day, but we think that we've done the right thing.
Andre Davis is the city solicitor of Baltimore. Our number here on Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. You can send us a tweet and catch us on the WYPR Facebook page. I'm Tom Hall. Let's go to Tom in Mount Vernon. Welcome to Midday with Andre Davis.
Thanks for your program today, everybody. I'm just wondering, with the recent cyber attack, predators usually go after the most disoriented and weak of victims. And these cyber people seem very sophisticated. Do you think they did research and looked around cities that appeared that they'll be easy targets? And do you think that dysfunctional and perhaps unethical behavior from some people in city government has attracted these people?
Thanks for that call, Tom.
Tom, I was privileged and honored, really, to serve for more than 6 years on the Information Technology Committee of the federal courts. And what has happened to the city, people may not know this, actually has happened to the federal courts. Not as badly as it's happened to the city, to be sure. But the use of viruses and other malware against government, private organizations, corporations, large organizations, small organizations, is nothing new. And unfortunately, the city has fallen victim. But I can tell the gentleman, the virus is out there searching for your computer right now. It's searching for mine. It's searching for yours. It's searching for all of the networks all over this country. The federal courts have been infected. Governments have been infected. Atlanta, of course, last year. So it's a constant battle. It's a constant battle. And people need to harden their own personal technology at home. And they need to, institutions, including governments, need to harden our protections. And that's what we're doing in Baltimore City. I don't think it was a targeted attack at all. I think it was just we got unlucky, and the hackers got lucky. They only need to get lucky once. We need to be lucky every time.
Last week, Mayor Young raised the specter that he hadn't completely ruled out the option of paying the ransom to get rid of this virus. This is a legal and a logistical matter because people at City Hall really are stymied. I mean, they have no email, no voicemail. What's your thought on that?
Well, I was in the room and we met, had very serious discussions with our tech partners, with the FBI and other law enforcement specialists in the field. And the decision ultimately was made, as the mayor said, not to pay. Paying gets you short-term relief, perhaps, but doesn't guarantee anything. So the city has made the decision, which I fully supported, and there was no disagreement among city officials that we should not pay in this instance.
Where do things stand as of today? How are people producing documents? How are people functioning?
People are not going to be happy hearing this again, but we are making progress. It is a slow, laborious process, but we are making progress. And as Frank Johnson, our chief technology officer, has repeatedly said, we're going to come out of this on the other side stronger and better walled off from threats than ever before. But I can't speculate as to when exactly we're going to be back fully online. As one might suspect, our focus right now is getting the finance department back and running so that payments can be made to vendors. We have got a number of small business people out there who rely on their income from the city contracts. And, of course, the city wants to be able to receive payments. Rudy Child, Director of Public Works, is anxious to get back up so that people can pay their water bills. So we're all focused on the priorities that are important to the city.
When it comes to that kind of thing, people, the city can process paper checks?
Yes.
They can deposit paper checks?
Yes.
But you can't pay online, that kind of thing?
That's right.
When it comes to paying, this is going to end up being a very expensive proposition for the city as well.
It will be a hit to the city fisc. But we're not in a position where we can cut corners on what we need to do.
We want to go to the phones again to Roberta in Hamden. Roberta, welcome to Midday with City Solicitor Andre Davis.
Well, thank you, Tom. I was curious if Mr. Davis would comment about his comment regarding the JHU students' protest and getting arrested last week when he said that he was happy no one had gotten run over. And I don't know if I just read that out of context, but I was just horrified that he would even think that our Baltimore police would run over students at Johns Hopkins University after a peaceful protest that had lasted a month. And if he could also speak to the heavy-handed response by the police by having 80 policemen and the Foxtrot helicopter up in the air from 5 o'clock in the morning on.
Okay, thanks for the call. This is concerning the students who had taken over Garland Hall, the administrative building at Johns Hopkins. As the caller mentioned, they'd been there for quite a while, and the police did come in and arrest them.
Thank you for that call and for those questions. I'm really pleased to have the opportunity to elaborate a little bit. What I said was that I, as the city solicitor and the principal official responsible for implementing the federal court consent decree, which is the foundation for the reforms of the Baltimore City Police, I was proud of Commissioner Harrison's department and the manner in which they carried out that operation. And I'm not going to take a long time, but people need to understand. Frankly, ma'am, I'm afraid it was not a peaceful protest. When students go into a university building used by other students and administrators and faculty and chain the doors locked, that is not a peaceful demonstration. I know what you mean by that, but that called for a response. And what the Baltimore City Police did in consultation with the university was to take a very carefully measured, restrained approach that included warning the students who had taken over that building what was going to happen, to give them the opportunity to cease and desist from their obstructive behavior, not the peaceful protest, but the obstructive behavior. And unfortunately, while some students took advantage of the offer of amnesty and the offer to declare victory and walk away, there were those who took a different approach and would not leave voluntarily. And in fact, word went out when there were reports that Baltimore City Police were on their way to bring an end to the shutdown of the building. Word went out on social media calling for people to come and enhance the presence, the obstructive capacity of the protesters to thwart the Baltimore City Police Department's efforts to restore peace and order to Johns Hopkins. So we respect the First Amendment rights of all our citizens and residents, including students, most particularly students. There were complaints that there were too many police. And our caller mentioned the helicopter. Well, it was the middle of the night, and there were rumors about that there were maybe 80 students in the building. The police did not know how many students they were dealing with. So to maintain order, to ensure the safety of everyone involved, a contingent of officers responded to the matter, handled the matter completely in accordance with the federal consent decree's mandates for how First Amendment rights are respected by Baltimore City Police. And when people lay down on the, in the street in an effort to thwart the departure of the vans, those people were handled gently, respectfully, and that was the context in which my statement was made that no one was run over. Of course, Baltimore City Police would never run over anybody. But when students try hard enough to get run over, we can't be sure that some of them won't succeed. So it was a successful protest. Hopkins was heard. The community was heard. And it was a successful end to the protest, in my judgment.
And we will talk more about the police and the status of civilian review boards in particular when we come back. Quick break, and we will have more with Baltimore City Solicitor Andre Davis. You are welcome to join us at 410-662-8780. You can send us an email, midday@wypr.org. You can drop us a tweet at @MiddayWYPR, and you can catch us on the WYPR Facebook page. I'm Tom Hall. Stick around. Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you're just joining us today, Andre Davis is my guest. He is the Baltimore City Solicitor. In other words, he's Baltimore's top lawyer. He was appointed to the post by then-Mayor Catherine Pugh in September of 2017 after 30 years as a judge, including 8 years on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit. Our number is 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle, @MiddayWYPR, and we are streaming on the WYPR Facebook page. Let's talk about the Civilian Review Board, which is part of this consent decree. This is to have civilian participation in so-called trial boards, where police officers are accused of malfeasance of one kind or another. Where does that stand at this point?
Two different things, Tom. I'm glad to have the opportunity to clarify. The Civilian Review Board, created nearly 20 years ago, actually a little more than 20 years ago, in Annapolis by state statute, was set up to serve as an oversight agency in the city to review complaints against law enforcement officers, not just the Baltimore City Police Department, but really all the law enforcement agencies operating in Baltimore City, which includes, for example, the Morgan State Police and the school police. Unfortunately, the Civilian Review Board has very, very limited authority, and that's frustrated, frankly, every member and leader of that organization for the 20 years that it's existed. Matters came to a head somewhat last year, and people are widely, I think, knowledgeable about the dispute that they focused their attention on the city law department, viewing the city law department as an impediment to their work.
Yeah, there's a lot of folks who think that you're the reason that they have limited authority.
Right, exactly. But no, I had nothing to do with it back in 1999 when it was created in Annapolis. The good news is that despite earlier difficulties, the police department and the Civilian Review Board, which comes under the Baltimore City Office of Civil Rights and Wage Enforcement, through the good offices of the Monitor, the Federal Consent Decree Monitor, and the Department of Justice input, we now have a working agreement between the Baltimore City Police Department Internal Affairs Division and the Civilian Review Board to work cooperatively to review complaints and to do joint investigations or parallel investigations when appropriate. That's one thing. Now, separate from that entirely, something I'm very excited about is the two civilian members on the trial boards that will actually adjudicate complaints against Baltimore City police officers. And that came about as a result of, frankly, some hard-nosed negotiations that the city conducted last year, really throughout the year, with the Fraternal Order of Police. People will remember that then-Mayor Pugh made it one of her absolute must-haves in those negotiations, namely to have two members of the civilian of the two members of the police trial boards be civilians. So we, as of July 1st, we will have trial boards going forward that consist not only of three police officers, which is the way it's been up until now, but they will consist of, those trial boards will consist of five members, three police officers and two civilians, all five voting members with the opportunity after a hearing to state the reasons for their decisions. And frankly, people should know, as we try to get the word out, the application for civilian members of these future trial boards is posted on the websites of the Baltimore City Police Department and the City Law Department. And despite the ransomware shutdown of much of city government, our websites are still operating. So I hope that many listeners will go to the City Law Department website and fill out the application to become a member of these trial boards, because it's going to be very important to have civilian input into these decisions. I anticipate that there will be votes in the future. Perhaps it'll be 3-2, guilty or not guilty. Perhaps sometimes the three will be all the police officers, but there'll be times when it'll be one police officer and two civilians, or maybe two police officers and one civilian. The point is, the decision-making process will be enriched, the transparency that will be achieved will be heightened, and I think that we're going to see a real improvement in the disciplinary and accountability processes applicable to Baltimore City police officers.
When you talk about the purview, there are people who have expressed concern that the purview is no longer with the city's Office of Civil Rights and Wage Enforcement, and in fact, it's under the purview of your office, the law department, the city solicitor's office, and they say that that's a problem because you are the police, you're the lawyer for the police department. You negotiate contracts with them and you defend them when they are sued by the city or individual officers are sued by the city. Is there not a conflict there?
There is not a conflict. That people continue to say that, continue to believe that. The fact of the matter is the Civilian Review Board does not have an independent lawyer. Whether it should is a question I think worth discussing. But that discussion has to take place in Annapolis. And, there was a bill in the legislature this past session which the city delegation rejected in order to create a more independent civilian review board. And I'm not opposed to that.
But will the trial board be under the purview of the law department or the Office of Civil Rights?
The trial board is under the purview of the police department. The trial board's decisions go to the police commissioner. And if it's not guilty under existing law, if the trial board's decision is not guilty, that's the end of the case. And if it's guilty,
Then the commissioner has
discretion to decide what the punishment or the sanction should be, from termination to loss of leave or other similar lesser punishments.
Were concerned. I mean, obviously there's a gentle balance here, a delicate balance about transparency and efficacy and fairness. You were concerned about board members signing confidentiality agreements.
Yes.
Wanted them to do it. There was a dispute about that, and it appears that you've reached an agreement where they're not going to be required to sign confidentiality agreements. Are you worried? What are your concerns in that regard?
Well, my main concern is that people don't understand the limitations imposed by law. And I understand the frustration. There was a quotation in the reporting recently from the outgoing chair of the board. And I can't recall what he said precisely, but it was something like this. I thought we were independent and had authority. That's what he said. Again, that's a paraphrase. I thought when he was appointed and his colleagues were appointed by then Mayor Pugh back in January of 2017, they came in believing that they were independent and had authority. They were not under the law department then. It was then Mayor Pugh who later said, I want the Office of Civil Rights to report up to the mayor, through the law department. And that made perfect sense, and it still makes perfect sense in my judgment. I work very well with the new director of the Office of Civil Rights, Darnell Ingram, a lawyer who has extraordinary experience, was appointed last year by Mayor Pugh. But the problem, people don't like hearing me say this, the problem is in the law. The problem is not in the law department. There is no conflict in having the law department represent every city agency. And in any event, if you want an independent lawyer to represent the interest of the Civilian Review Board, let's all go to Annapolis together. Let's craft a good bill and get the city delegation behind that bill. That didn't happen this year.
We have a number of emails, one's from Bob, another's from Catherine, and the gist of their emails are essentially the same. Bob says, what do you think regarding fundamental institutional changes within city government? It clearly appears that there are fundamental checks and balances that are lacking. And Catherine says, how can the system possibly be cleaned up? It was very poignant on the day that Catherine Pugh resigned. You gave a press conference outside of City Hall, and you were quite emotional at that moment. This has been people have had an emotional reaction to this entire series of episodes, and these episodes are not over because there's an investigation that continues. What are the lessons learned here? We have a few minutes left. What in your mind is the way forward in terms of whether it's ethics forms and how things are reported or how the charter might be revised to prevent this kind of alleged unethical behavior to take place in the future, and to see that if it does, a quick remedy can be employed? Because the city council in particular was very frustrated that even though they all said that they voted that Mayor Pugh should resign, they had no recourse in terms of removing her from office themselves.
Yeah, that's a very big question, Tom, and I know we don't have all the time I would need to give a fulsome answer, but there are a couple of things I will say. First of all, it seems clear to most people that the city ethics law needs to be revised, and the enforcement of that law needs to be given to the Inspector General. No question about it. The Inspector General is, in fact, the investigative agency that works with the City Ethics Board. But the Ethics Board has no real funding stream. It has no real capacity to take enforcement actions. It's a passive agency. So that's one big thing. Beyond that, as we all know, a number of council members have put in bills aiming to modify the charter, to switch the city government from a strong mayor type of government into something else. And my understanding is that Mayor Young is not explicitly supportive or opposed to any of those. What he has said, and it seems to me to make sense, is let's get to next year when we have time to really study some of these issues and make whatever changes ultimately, first of all, the council believes is appropriate, and then put it to the people to see what the people think. We have a strong mayor form of government, but we also have a weak ethics law with little enforcement mechanisms in place. So there is room for improvement, no question about it. But the people need to make good decisions in their elections, and they need to study the issues, they need to study the background of people, and they need to hold people accountable.
Speaking of decisions, as we finish up, why did you decide to leave the federal judiciary, the Fourth Circuit, where you were a highly respected judge and had been in the judiciary for 30 years? Why did you decide to say at this point in your career, I'm not going to do this anymore, I'm going to come work for the city of Baltimore? Did Catherine Pugh talk you into this? Was this an idea that you had on your own? How did this come to be?
I certainly didn't have the idea on my own. Tom, love of place. Love of place. I love this city. As I've said repeatedly, this city nurtured me, made me what I am. And then Mayor-elect Pugh, when she reached out to me to join her administration. Yes, she was speaking for herself, but my perception then as now was that she was speaking on behalf of the people of Baltimore City. And I am so honored and privileged that I've had this opportunity. I haven't looked back. I don't regret a second of my service. I think I've had a positive impact. Things haven't gone exactly the way I anticipated, but they haven't gone exactly the way anybody anticipated. So this opportunity at this stage in my career to give back to the city I love, it's just invaluable.
You're going to stick around?
I'm sticking around. I serve at the pleasure of Mayor Young, and I will be here for as long as he wants me here.
Well, I appreciate your being here in Studio A with me today, Mr. Solicitor. It's always a pleasure to see you. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Tom.
Andre Davis is Baltimore City Solicitor. That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow on the program, Lawrence Lanahan joins me to talk about his new book, The Lines Between Us, Two Families and a Quest to Cross Baltimore's Racial Divide. The book is based on the award-winning WYPR radio series that aired in 2012 and 2013. We'll be joined by Mark Carter. He's the executive director of the Newsong Community Learning Center in Sandtown, Winchester. That's one of the places that gets a lot of attention in The Lines Between Us. So our conversation with Lawrence Lanahan and Mark Carter coming up tomorrow on Midday Plus. Theater critic J. Wynn Russick will review Queen's Girl in Africa and Queen's Girl in the World. Those are two new plays at Baltimore's Everyman Theater. So we hope you can join us tomorrow on Midday. Lunch today was provided by Dangerously Delicious Pies. They've got locations at 2839 O'Donnell Street on the square in Canton and also at 810 West 36th Street in Hamden. Their menu includes a large variety of homemade sweet and savory pies and quiches. You can find more information on the web at dangerouspiesbalt.com. Here and Now is up next after the news at the top of the hour. I'm Tom Hall. Appreciate your being with us. Have a great day.